Today is Monday, the 23rd of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden provides an update on Afghanistan evacuation efforts.
As of this morning, we have evacuated nearly 28,000 people since August the 14th.
Plus, talks continue on what the new government of Afghanistan will look like.
Neither side is really sharing any details exactly what is being talked about in these meetings, which have been taking place nonstop.
We'll have these stories and more next. The Taliban on Sunday blamed the United States for the chaos around Kabul's international airport, where thousands of people have been trying to leave following the insurgent group's takeover of the country. On Saturday, U.S. citizens in Afghanistan who want to leave the country were advised not to go to the airport unless they had received individual instructions from a U.S. government representative to do so. Security alert advisory from the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan seems to have added to the confusion and panic as thousands of people surrounded Kabul's international airport hoping to find transport out of the country. The British Ministry of Defense confirmed on Saturday that seven Afghans were killed near the airport in a panicked crush of people trying to enter the facility. On Sunday, U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the nation, providing an update on the U.S. withdrawal and evacuation efforts.
As of this morning, we have evacuated nearly 28,000 people since August the 14th on both U.S. and coalition aircraft, including civilian charters, bringing the total number of people we've evacuated since July to approximately 33,000 persons.
Biden says that the efforts of U.S. forces and allies at the Kabul airport prove that they can move thousands of people out each day. But he also added,
let me be clear. The evacuation of thousands of people from Kabul is going to be hard and painful no matter when it started, when we began. It would have been true if we had started a month ago or a month from now. There is no way to evacuate this many people without pain and loss of heartbreaking images you see on television.
Over the weekend, the Pentagon activated the use of 18 civilian U.S. passenger jets from six airlines to help ferry Americans and Afghans from safe havens where they were staying after leaving Kabul. In addition, Taliban leaders met with other prominent Afghan leaders to discuss what the form of the new government should take. Joining us is VOA's Ayaz Gul, who's following all the developments from Islamabad.
Well, Steve, as of this moment, you know, I spoke to a Taliban spokesman, Muhammad Naeem, and asked him, you know, that these consultations have been going on for now several days. So he wasn't sure whether this process of Taliban engaging with their former rivals in Kabul and trying to basically agree on some kind of a framework that will then be used to discuss difficult issues before they actually agree on the formation of this inclusive government that the Taliban have promised. Neither side is really sharing any details exactly what is being talked about in these meetings, which have been taking place nonstop. Yes, the discussions are ongoing, but Taliban repeatedly are promising that whatever inclusive government they will arrange to govern the country will ensure protection of women's rights, human rights, and that it will be in line with whatever the international community has been expecting. But again, they emphasize that this administration that they are proposing in collaboration with the other Afghan politicians will be working within the framework of Islamic law or Sharia.
Over the weekend, there was reporting that an opposition group to the Taliban had secured three districts. What else can you tell us about that and its significance?
Well, Steve, there's only one province left in Afghanistan, which is still not under the control of the Taliban, and that is the Panjshir province in the north. And that is where Taliban faced difficulties in overcoming even during their previous regime. And now we see again that residents of this valley or this province taken up arms against the Taliban. And from there, the province which borders the Panjshir province is called Baghlan. And that's where these anti-Taliban fighters captured three districts and were still making advances. But let me tell you that as of this moment, we know for sure that thousands of Taliban fighters have been dispatched to this area and the Panjshir Valley. And an ultimatum has been served on the opposition fighters in Panjshir Valley. And the Taliban have said that if the fighters in this Panjshir province and the surrounding areas do not surrender, then they are going to launch a massive attack. This is one part of Afghanistan, but if Taliban are unable to really overcome this challenge quickly, obviously this may encourage loyalists of the former government elsewhere in Afghanistan to put up some kind of resistance or arrange some kind of resistance. So we don't know yet, but the Taliban appeared from their statements confident that they will be able to fight back and take control of Panjshir very soon. That's what they say. But let's see, because that Panjshir province, Taliban never conquered when they were in control of Afghanistan in the 1990s.
VOA's Ayaz Gul spoke to me from Islamabad, Pakistan. Reuters News reports that a week after the Taliban seizure of Kabul, growing numbers of people in the Afghan capital are facing a daily struggle to get by with their jobs gone, banks still shuttered, and food prices soaring. The World Health Organization is also sounding the alarm about health care in Afghanistan, where the conflict has left millions of people vulnerable to hunger and illness. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
About one half of Afghanistan's population, including more than 4 million women and nearly 10 million children, need humanitarian assistance. The World Health Organization says one third of the population is facing acute hunger, and more than half of all children under age 5 are malnourished. It says the current drought is expected to worsen an already dire situation. WHO officials say they are committed to staying in Afghanistan and delivering critical health care services. However, WHO spokesman Tariq Jazarevich notes that only will be possible if all parties in the war-torn country respect and protect civilians, health workers, and health facilities.
Continuity of health services must continue without interruption across the country, with a focus on ensuring women have access to female health workers. Most of major health facilities are functional, and this is based on a provincial level field monitoring. Health workers have been called to return to or to remain in their posts, including female health staff.
The new Taliban rulers of Afghanistan have promised to protect women's rights and allow them to work and study. However, since they have seized control of the country, there have been reports of female workers having been dismissed from their jobs. Nearly 300,000 Afghans have fled their homes in the last 2 months, fearing for their safety as U.S. and NATO forces hastened their departure from the country. Jazarevich says those newly displaced people are extremely vulnerable. They lack food, shelter, and many suffer from a variety of health problems.
In areas where people have recently fled, including Kabul, WHO received field reports of increase in cases in diarrhea, malnutrition, high blood pressure, COVID-19, black symptoms, and reproductive health complications. When it comes to trauma cases, close to 14,000 conflict-related trauma received at 70 WHO health facilities in July 21.
He says that is more than three times higher than the number of trauma cases received during the same period last year. The WHO spokesman says attacks on healthcare facilities also pose a major challenge. In the first half of this year, he notes 26 health facilities were damaged and 31 healthcare workers were assaulted. He adds 12 of the health workers were killed.
Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. The WHO says medical supplies and equipment are in short supply. It also says the most pressing needs for reproductive and child health services and nutrition supplements to address rising malnutrition among children, especially those affected by conflict. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Two Palestinians, one of them a 13-year-old boy, and an Israeli soldier were wounded in renewed fighting along the Gaza border. Hundreds of Palestinian protesters came to the Gaza border to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque more than 50 years ago. The new tensions come as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett meets U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington later on in this week. And Linda Gradstein has those details.
An Israeli army spokesman said protesters began gathering at the border fence on Saturday afternoon, and Palestinians threw explosives and rocks across the border at Israeli soldiers. The army said the soldiers responded with crowd dispersal means, including live fire. Palestinians released a video that showed them trying to grab the gun of an Israeli soldier who poked it through a hole in the fence the soldiers used as a sniper position. The video shows a Palestinian shooting a pistol through the same hole, hitting the Israeli soldier in the head. Israel responded with attacks on Hamas weapons stores in Gaza, but military analysts said the response was low-key. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Israel will not accept attacks on its soldiers. He said that Israel will settle the score with anyone who attacks its soldiers. It is the most tense the border between Israel and Gaza has been since May, when the two sides fought an 11-day war that left at least 260 Palestinians and 13 people in Israel dead. It also comes as Bennett is scheduled to hold his first meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden. While the Palestinian issue will be on the agenda, Israel is even more concerned about the possibility of Iran becoming a nuclear power. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In addition, a state inquiry into a stampede at a Jewish pilgrimage site that killed 45 people in April began hearing witnesses on Sunday to find out what led to Israel's worst civilian disaster. Tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews gathered at the Galilee hillside tomb of a second-century sage for the annual La Ba'omer festival. Now, during that ceremony, part of the crowd surged into a narrow tunnel, and 45 men and boys were asphyxiated or trampled upon. U.S. and Canadian citizens were also among the dead. Israel's government watchdog years ago deemed that the Mount Moriah site was hazardous. Although the number of worshippers was lower than usual, it still exceeded the total that was permitted at the time by COVID-19 measures. Some Israelis had questioned whether the former government under Benjamin Netanyahu and police were reluctant to further limit the crowd size because of pressure from influential ultra-Orthodox leaders. Lebanon's gas prices are on the rise to 66%. A huge hike that aims to ease crippling shortages will mean more hardship for ordinary people. Reuters' Lucy Fielder is up next.
The Lebanese government is raising gasoline prices by two-thirds as it tries to ease crippling fuel shortages that have brought the country to a standstill. But Sunday's step will mean yet more hardship for Lebanese, more than half of whom have been pushed into poverty over the past couple of years by a financial meltdown, which has wiped more than 90% off the value of the Lebanese pound. Lebanon's fuel crisis has brought basic services to their knees, and queuing for hours at gas stations in a daily scramble for fuel has become part of life. Hospitals, bakeries and many businesses are also scaling back or shutting down as fuel runs dry. The crisis worsened this month when the central bank said it could no longer finance fuel imports at heavily subsidized rates and would switch to market exchange rates instead. Price increases will take effect immediately, the government said in a statement. The rise does not fully lift the exchange rate for pricing fuel to the rate at which the central bank will finance its imports, so the state will have to fund the gap for now. Lebanon's Hezbollah, which is backed by Tehran, has arranged for a shipment of fuel from Iran to help ease the shortage in Lebanon.
Lucy Fielder reports for Reuters News. Australia's Delta variant outbreak is spreading into outback areas. The vast majority of new infections are among Aboriginal people. Phil Mercer reports that in New South Wales, 60% of cases are in Indigenous communities where vaccination rates are low and vaccine hesitancy is high.
There are COVID-19 health campaigns in various Australian Aboriginal languages, but in Western New South Wales state, fewer than 10% of First Nation people are fully vaccinated, well below the national average. Health officials have said that vaccine hesitancy has been promoted by misinformation online and concerns about possible side effects of the AstraZeneca drug. Indigenous elder Frank Doolan told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that he's watched as the virus has spread through Dubbo, a New South Wales city, 400 kilometres northwest of Sydney.
I can't even contemplate catching COVID, really. I kind of think if that happens in that regard, then I'm dead.
The community's fears about the spread of the virus are shared by Dubbo Mayor Stephen Lawrence.
We always knew that our Aboriginal community was going to be especially vulnerable to COVID-19 and especially hard to reach in terms of vaccination. And look, that has certainly turned out to be the case.
The Australian government says Indigenous people in remote areas remain a priority for vaccines and that the military will be deployed to help in the inoculation program. However, this outbreak of the Delta variant is now threatening communities already hit by chronic illnesses, including diabetes, as well as lung and heart disease. Indigenous Australians make up 3.3% of the national population, according to official figures. Australia has recorded about 40,000 coronavirus cases and 970 deaths since the beginning of the pandemic. Authorities said Thursday that more than half of Australians aged over 16 have now had at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. 28% are fully inoculated. Millions of Australians are in lockdown, including residents in the nation's two biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, as well as the national capital, Canberra. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tropical storm Henri made landfall in the eastern U.S. state of Rhode Island on Sunday. The storm, recently downgraded from a hurricane, knocked out power in tens of thousands of homes as much of the region braced for possible flooding and increased rain. The National Hurricane Center said that New York's Long Island and southern New England should prepare for dangerous storm surges and flooding rainfall. Haitian officials reported Sunday that the death toll from last week's 7.2 magnitude earthquake in Lacai rose to 2,207. According to Haiti's Civil Protection Service, more than 50,000 homes have been destroyed and 344 people remain missing. More than 12,000 have been injured by the quake. The United Nations estimates that more than 1 million people have been affected by the latest crisis. Two more local journalists have been arrested in Myanmar, according to an army-owned television network. Reporters Without Borders said that the pair were being held incommunicado. Myanmar has remained unstable since a February 1st coup, and while the junta says it respects press freedom, will not allow reporting that it deems false. According to activists, more than 1,000 people have been killed since the coup. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris arrived Sunday in Singapore at the start of a short Southeast Asia trip. Late Tuesday, Harris arrives in Vietnam, becoming the first U.S. Vice President to visit Hanoi as Washington seeks to bolster international support to counter China's growing global influence. ¶¶
This is Science in a Minute.
Because of a growing problem called light pollution, more of us are unable to witness the full, breathtaking beauty and majesty of the sparkling Milky Way. Light pollution is defined as the brightening of the night sky from artificial light sources such as streetlights. A new study from scientists in the U.S., Slovakia, and Spain provides evidence that satellites and other artificial objects that orbit Earth are also contributing more to light pollution than previously understood. The study, published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, Letters, suggests that these Earth-orbiting objects may be increasing light pollution across a large segment of our planet by more than 10% above natural light levels. Study authors say the orbital objects include not only operating satellites, but large swaths of space junk as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The last surviving leader of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge, Khieu Samphan, launched his final defense in appealing his conviction for genocide last week. This, at the long-running United Nations-backed tribunal, held its last public hearings before winding down. Luke Hunt has that story.
Amid tight security and health restrictions imposed to guard against the COVID-19 pandemic, former Khmer Rouge head of state, Khieu Samphan, delivered a dramatic 16-minute appeal in which he categorically refused to accept his 2018 conviction for genocide against Cambodia's Muslim Cham and ethnic Vietnamese. Khieu Samphan told the court, "I am alone in front of you. I am judged symbolically rather than by my actual deed and as an individual. That's the end." With that, the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia ended 15 years of public hearings into the deaths of 2 million people between 1975 and 1979, when Cambodia was ruled by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. Nearly all senior Khmer Rouge leaders died behind bars, awaiting trial, or in violent circumstances. Only Khieu Samphan, 91, survives. He was convicted of genocide alongside Nguyen Chia, known as Brother Number 2, who died 2 years ago. Helen Jarvis, a former chief of the court's public affairs and victim support sections, says it took a Herculean effort to get the tribunal up and running.
It was a very important historical event that needed to be done. It was long overdue to recognize the crimes that had taken place here, crimes against humanity, genocide. It needed to be done. I think it has been done.
U Virak, president of the Future Forum think tank in Phnom Penh, says the tribunal has played an important role in Cambodia's development and will provide historians with much greater insights into the regional political dynamics of the 1970s by the major powers, the United States, the Soviet Union, and China.
Because of that, I think there will be more interest in the tribunal, not because of historical atrocities, but more so because of its relevance to the current geopolitical discussions.
A decision on Khieu Samphan's appeal is not expected until late next year. Even if he wins, the 91-year-old will remain behind bars for life after exhausting appeals for his 2014 conviction for crimes against humanity. Either way, authorities can now plan commemorations for Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot's victims, who are expected to be cremated in accordance with traditional Buddhist rites, delivering some closure for one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. Luke Hunt for VOA News, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
The newly released film Stillwater is a drama involving an American father who travels to Marseille, France, to help exonerate his daughter of murder. Amanda Knox, who faced the same fate in Italy, has criticized filmmaker Tom McCarthy for tailoring the story of her wrongful murder conviction too closely and inaccurately to the film's plot. The Academy Award-winning filmmaker told VOA that his film is not about Knox, but about a father-daughter relationship. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
You're in Marseille for vacation?
Yeah, I'll visit my daughter.
Bill Baker, an American oil rig roughneck from Oklahoma, is determined to help free his estranged daughter, Allison, who is serving a murder sentence in Marseille for murdering her lover, a crime she claims she did not commit. Matt Damon portrays Bill.
I loved her.
I know you did.
But everybody thinks that I killed her.
The film has been criticized by American author, activist, and journalist Amanda Knox, who at the age of 20, while studying in Perugia, Italy, was convicted of the murder of her roommate, Meredith Kercher. After serving years in an Italian jail, Knox was acquitted by the Italian Supreme Court. Knox told VOA that Tom McCarthy and Matt Damon not only copied, but also distorted her story.
He took that and then cast the Amanda Knox character in the same kind of light as my prosecution did. So he's furthering this pernicious and false narrative that there's something about me that is guilty.
I like the seed of the Amanda Knox case. That was it. There's no other parallel, as far as I know, in this story. And I know that case pretty well because I was fascinated with it back then. But this isn't a comment on that in any way.
It's about a guy who, a type of guy, really, who is feeling increasingly powerless in the new world that we're all moving into, that's moving really fast and leaving him behind. And a lot comes out of that, you know, a lot of rage and a lot of sadness and shame.
My daughter is innocent.
What? Oh, I can't believe this conversation.
I'm trying to get my little girl out of jail.
And you sound very American right now.
Good, I am.
Yeah, and you're also a stranger here.
Actress Camille Cotin plays Virginie, a French woman helping Bill track the young man his daughter claims is the murderer. But the trail of information is leading nowhere, frustrating Bill, who decides to take matters into his own hands.
I was trying to help.
Tell me exactly what you did, Dad.
While Bill is trying to free his daughter in Marseille, he builds a new life with Virginie and her young daughter, Maya, trying to free himself of a traumatic past of addiction and incarceration. McCarthy says the film also alludes to Americans' psychological displacement at home and abroad.
I don't care where you sit on the political, socioeconomic spectrum. You can see we are struggling right now as a country, as a democracy, trying to find our footing, trying to find some sort of reconciliation.
Knox says she understands that most stories come from real shared experience, but she adds their ethics in the way a story should be told and whether it is exploiting someone's image like hers.
I think that's an interesting conversation that Hollywood is having right now, because we are recognizing that not everyone gets to tell a story, and that in the past, what that has meant is that stereotypes and myths about kinds of people have been perpetuated in storytelling that has met a mass market and a mass audience, and that there have been real consequences to that to real people.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News.
And finally, singer Don Everly of the Everly Brothers has died in Nashville, Tennessee at the age of 84. That's according to his attorney. No details were given. Associated Press music correspondent Margie Zerilotta has this look at his career.
The Everly Brothers combined pop, rock, and country with distinctive harmonies for a sound that influenced many groups who followed. Bye Bye Love was their first hit, reaching number two in 1957. They followed that up with the number one song, Wake Up Little Susie. Other Everly Brothers hits include All I Have to Do Is Dream, When Will I Be Loved, and Kathy's Clown. Here he comes. The Everlys broke up on stage in 1973 and did not reunite for 10 years. They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as part of the first class in 1986. Phil Everly died in 2014. I'm Margie Zaraletta.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.